Welcome to the Bomb and Gouge podcast. I'm your host, Gary Bissell. This week, I'm joined by associate head coach of the women's basketball team at Grand Valley State and possibly the biggest Tiger Woods fan on the planet, Phil Sayers. We're going to talk about Tiger's 15th major win at Augusta, as well as the upcoming NBA playoffs and NBA free agency this offseason. But first, a word from our sponsor. All right, I'd like to welcome all the listeners in. I'd also like to welcome in the associate head coach of the women's basketball team at Grand Valley State University, an avid golf fan, maybe the biggest Tiger fan on the planet, Phil Sayers.
Biss, it is great to be here, and great to be here on a day like today. I mean, unbelievable day.
A holiday, maybe, from now
on. I had my wedding, the birth of my three kids, the 97 Masters. And I'm going to go with today might be maybe the sixth or seventh best day of my life.
All right, Phil. So obviously Tiger won his 15th major today and first major in 11 years and first Masters in 14 years. Obviously, a lot of the media and just fans in general had written him off is after his personal issues and all of his injuries, specifically the back surgeries were the big ones, is maybe never winning again, especially not a major. So first, talk to me a little bit about what does this mean to you as a Tiger fan? And also, I'd like to get a little information. Why are you such a Tiger? Like, what is it about Tiger that you love so much?
I think it's just where I was when he first came around. I mean, think about it. I was 17 in 97 when he first won his first Masters. And I still think back to even his junior golf days, you know, his win at Sawgrass and the salmon and white, you know, thick striped shirt with the straw hat on. And he made the putt with a fist pump. And he, you know, I was 14, 15 years old and just learning about golf and just getting into golf as a fan at that time. And so I think you're gravitated to your favorite players of any sport. I mean, I grew up a San Francisco Giants fan because of Will Clark, like, you know, Tigers fan and a San Francisco Giants fan. So I think it was just one of those things where you watch what's popular. And when you are in that teenage years, and I just gravitated to him. I mean, his guts to do what he did and just his demeanor when he played back in the early 2000s was just unbelievable to watch, and to see it go away and have him. And I still think back to that shot he hit, I believe it was at Doral, the three wood that he just pulled left and goes down to his knees in pain. You think he's never going to play at a high level again. And to see this happen today, pretty impressive.
Well, especially obviously with back surgeries. If you know anyone who's had a major back surgery, you know, it's pretty personal to me because my dad was a college wrestler and had some major back injuries that stem back from that. And he's had two really major back surgeries, you know, putting screws and rods in the whole deal. And my dad was an avid golfer and he's never been able to play regularly since. Forget an 8-hour-a-day practice schedule. I mean, just playing, you know, playing more than once every couple weeks is pretty challenging for him ever since his back surgeries. And so now I'm not going to compare my dad to Woods in terms of, you know, level of commitment to the sport of golf and this and that. And, you know, what Tiger, the things that he has access to in terms of a training and rehab. But still, if you know anyone with a major back surgery, like it's, you know, I'd put it up there. It was as tough as of an injury as there is to come back from. And I think we saw, you know, maybe this isn't possible in a sport like golf where there's so much rotation and usage of your back. And so I think it speaks more volume to, you know, how elite he is in every way as an athlete and as a person and his level of commitment and grit. Cause it would have been so easy to say, you know what? I had a great run. I don't know if I'm ever going to return to form. And this is it. Like so many other great athletes have before, you know, we've seen maybe not to the level of Tiger. We've seen a lot of great athletes have to hang it up early because of injury. And this just is another amazing story. You know, we'll talk about some of the other comeback stories today, but You know, this is one of the all-time greats. I mean, holy. Well,
it's crazy. And I was watching the par three the other day, and you listen to Jack Nicklaus talk at his age, just how difficult it is to walk the nine holes on the par three course. And here's a course. You talk about his back injury, where the only level lies you have probably all 4 days, you know, 5-6 days of practice rounds are on the tee box. And so you're hitting shots constantly uphill, downhill, side lie, below your feet, you know, above your feet. And to trust your back, let alone on pine straw, I mean, you're not helping your situation at all around Augusta. And the walk itself is challenging. And so for him to do it, just kind of, like you say, with all the surgeries, it's even more impressive to do it on a course that is as undulating as Augusta.
Yeah, and to add to that, to me, the thing that has been most impressive, you know, when Tiger started to come back, I thought, okay, he is Tiger, so I'm not going to totally write him off, you know, but I didn't think he would really have much of a shot at a major ever again other than possibly the British, because the one thing I was convinced of, and I was very wrong of, is that he would never get speed back. To be in your 40s now and coming off major back surgeries, and when he first came back, he was swinging it much, much slower than in his prime. You know, he went from swinging it in the 120s with club head speed down to about 112. And that's a huge adjustment for a guy who, I'll give our podcast here a little plug, who was a bomb and gouger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He was a guy who just hit his driver as hard as he could a lot of times and hit it all over the place. And, okay, I'll just go figure it out. And I thought, well, he's going to have to totally revamp his game here and be more of, you know, a guy who hits it down the middle. And I thought he would have to learn to drive the golf ball better. The fact that he's gotten his speed back is unbelievable to me, especially at his age.
Well, yeah, he got his speed back, but he also now, I mean, you saw this week was when he had to dial it back, where he knew he had to find a fairway. He did that. I mean, a lot of players, after what he did at 10 and 11, they might not have the guts, number one, step up on 12 and hit that tee shot. It was made a little easier after Molinari dumped it in the water, and then to go to 13 and have to find the fairway. And he did that after really two bad drives back to back on 10 and 11. And so even if he had to take some back on that on 13, he's smart enough now in his age to play the golf course and give himself a chance to get on that green and two and hopefully make a putt. And he missed the eagle putt, but had an easy tap in birdie on 13 and got the momentum rolling again after picking up some strokes on 12. So his wisdom was also, his golf IQ is off the charts, and he's just so smart around Augusta. And you saw it time in and time out during the course of today's round, especially, but even the previous three rounds.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought up that shot on 12, because it was a perfect lead in, because I was going to talk about his golf IQ, and that's where Augusta, no doubt about it, is an experienced golf course. There's a reason why guys like Bernhard Langer and Fred Couples and these older guys, they can kind of hang around a little while at Augusta. And it's due to Augusta's an experienced golf course, you know, with so many slopes and different things going on around there in terms of knowing where it runs off to, where you're supposed to hit it. The guys who have played it a bunch have a huge advantage. And what he did on 12 was so brilliant, where Molinari drops it in the water, and then he hits it in what isn't a great shot for a touring pro from that distance. I mean, especially for one of the top 10 players in the world. You know, he hit it from inside 160 yards to, what, 40 feet? But
yep,
he hit it in between the bunkers, which is where you can't hit it in the water. Because if it spins off, it goes into a bunker. And if it goes a little long, it goes into a bunker where you can get a little more spin than you could out of the just more grass area back there. And so for him to do that was absolutely brilliant. And then 13 was really cool as well. I'm glad you mentioned that tee shot, because that one worried me a little bit, because that tee box was sloppy. He slipped a little bit from the mm-hmm. ring. And after he slipped, they flashed back to it, and you could see him reacting. And that tee box, you could tell it was pretty wet, and there you could see where people's feet were going, because it was much darker grass, and it was actually stomped in a little bit. So for him to get away with that was critical for him getting the win.
Well, it was huge. And I thought, you know, yesterday he hooked that one in the hit, came back, kick. Somehow it came out yesterday on 13. I have no idea how that ball came out. And so he just shanks two to the right on 10 and 11. he knows he can't lose to the right in the pine straw on 13 because he's not going to pull off a Mickelson type shot from there. So the fear of overdrawing it as well, it has to be playing his mind. You mentioned the wet tee box, the you know, sloppy start out there, and he puts it out there and he ends up with an 8-iron in his hand. I mean, it's just, he was really good. He was really good today.
Yeah, it was interesting because I was texting with the team a little bit. We've got some big Tiger fans on our team. And I was telling them, because they're young enough where they never really saw Tiger, right? They may have seen the 08 U.S. Open is probably the last thing they really remember. And we're talking about people that were born in, you know, 98, 99, 2000, 2001. And so they may remember the 08 U.S. Open, but that's about it, right?
Yeah.
And I was texting with them, and I was telling them, like, guys, this is for real. And I haven't been back on the Tiger train yet, but the thing that I saw today is he instinctively, in my opinion, went back to being the Tiger Woods of old, where he's almost a little bit of an asshole the way he looked. Right? Like, he's not engaging with the crowd at all. He's not smiling. He's not talking to his playing competitor. He's barely talking to his caddy other than just strictly, what do we need to do? And he went back to that you've seen so few athletes be able to get in that zone, right? The ones that come to mind are, for me, Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, and Tiger Woods.
I would agree. Yep.
Like, those are the three guys where their killer instinct was at such a high level that almost nothing could phase them once they got in that zone. And in my lifetime, I've never had three athletes that I thought were more fun to watch than those three, just because when they found that zone, I mean, it's like nothing anyone's ever seen.
Yeah. And he has that. And it was, you know, I'll tell you, I thought today, yes, he's in the zone. He was playing well. He's playing very patient. I mean, how he attacked, you know, even number three, after parring number two with a bad drive, he had a layup, and then he hit it short there on the approach, and it was a brilliant two putt. But then to come back with a really high IQ birdie again on three, with laying back, giving himself a full wedge into that left hole pin position. Looking back at the round, I knew it at the time it was big. I didn't know how big it was until he bogeyed number 10 and then drove it into trouble on 11. Biss, if you give me that putt on 9 and you tell me I can have 10 tries at that, if I two putt it one time out of 10, you'll give me $1,000. You can keep your money. I'm never two putting that putt out of 10 tries. That putt was unbelievable. And he referenced in his post round press conference, referenced, you know, of course, like 2002, he had that putt one time or something. It was a little more to the right, but it's like, how do you remember that? Number one, 16 years ago, you remember the putt you had on 9. But as a coach, talk about that two putt he had. I mean, just crazy good. And looking back, that was a big par.
Yeah, and it is. And like golf, and just like in all sports, it's a momentum game. And putting to me is always, Jordan Spieth said something back when he was going through his crazy putting year, when he was just unbelievable and basically setting records left and right for putting stats. And he talked about putting as the ultimate momentum, right? Because it's how you finish the hole. So it's that's how you carry momentum into the next hole. And I had never really thought about this before. And he said specifically, like, a 5 to 10 foot putt are always, or I think he said maybe 4 to 8 feet, somewhere in that neighborhood, kind of that short to mid range. You talk about those putts are always momentum killers or helpers, because they're in that range where if you make it, because they're like a 50-50 putt, right? Not 4 feet, obviously, but especially like 6, 7, 8 feet. If you look at PGA Tour statistics, like 8 feet is the 50% putt. And so they're in that range where you feel like you probably should make them, but they're definitely not guaranteed. And if you do make them, like you have a big par save from that distance, or you were to convert a great shot, you know, you get momentum going into the next hole. But whenever you miss them, you always lose momentum. And that's why it's not surprising when you see the winners of PGA Tour events, you know, they're always, whatever, 66 for 66 inside 8 feet, right?
Yeah.
They don't miss those momentum putts. But that's also what made this Masters so interesting to me, is Tiger did miss some of those. But in classic Tiger fashion, he didn't miss him today, right? He didn't miss him when it mattered. He missed him a little earlier in the week, but he made up for it with some long putts. But yeah, I mean, for him in terms of momentum today, I only got to watch the latter half of the round. I think it was the last 10 holes. But everything that I saw today, I mean, when there was opportunities where it could have gone wrong and he saved it, and then he took advantage of the opportunities he did have. You know, when he hit a great shot, he converted the birdie putt, which I can tell you, for me, you know, as a coach and a competitive golfer, I think nothing hurts momentum worse than hitting a great iron shot and not converting the putt. You know, when you hit it to 7 feet from 180 and then you miss it, even though a 7-footer is not a super easy putt, it always kills your momentum going to the next hole.
Yeah. And he, you know, he had no 3 putts today. He had one yesterday, I believe, on, I think it was on 14. He had one, but, or maybe it was on the front nine. He had a bad 3-putt, but, you know, I did see his one stat was that his distance from 20 plus, he ranked number one this week. And so he knows how to play the golf course. You know, he's okay putting it 30 feet away, 40 feet away, rather than risking a you know, heroic shot that could lead to a bogey or double bogey. You know, even look at the par 3-6 today. If you didn't catch that one, Molinari hits it over the green. He has to scramble. It was a stressful par for him. Tiger, yeah, puts it 15 feet below the hole. He misses their birdie putt. But, you know, it was like he just eased his way into number seven then, you know, whereas Molinari's stressing and stressing numerous times a day. And he knows how to just be patient around that golf course. And I just amazed. It was good for me as a guy with kids. I felt like Tiger today. I had to remind my kids who this guy was. You know, my oldest was born in 06, so she's never seen him win a Masters in her lifetime. And really only one major, and she was 2 years old, so she has no idea who this guy is. And so I made sure as a dad we watched it together, like I used to with my grandpa back in the day on Easter Sunday, watching Tiger play all the time. So I feel like I educated my girls today, which a little bit, which is also enjoyable.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about, this is already, we know the way media is in sports media, and this is going to get talked about for a while. And the questions are going to be all over all the talk shows tomorrow morning. And we might as well start it off, is where does this rank in great sports comebacks all time?
I mean, I think as far as a specific athlete goes, I mean, you can look at comebacks over the course of a year or a game or, you know, in a season where something happened. Or I think over the course of the long haul, to me, it's hands down, it's the best comeback that a specific athlete has ever had. I mean, as you mentioned, the number of back surgeries, you can mention his knee surgeries he's had. And what he's been through, yes, the off the course stuff, he could have controlled that a lot better. We can, that's fine, but that does play with you mentally and your psyche. But just the injuries alone, I mean, it was so bad. It was a struggle to watch there for a couple of years. Of all right, will he make it through one round or two before the cart has to come take him off, and he leaves with his sunglasses on, and Joey LaCava riding the back of the golf cart with his clubs, and they get in the car and they drive away. And that's what it was for two and a half years there consistently. And now to come back, that last January 28th, he played his first full round in over 2 years. Obviously he wins the tour championship, which, you know, he it's funny now, I saw this today. It's funny. He acknowledged today that the tour championship, well, that's just the 30 hottest golfers at the time, which when he won it, well, that was one of the big arguments, was, well, it wasn't a full field event. And he always said, well, I still beat 29 other pros. Well, now he wins the Masters, and now he backtracks a little bit. Like, it wasn't that big of a deal. There was just the 30 hottest golfers at the time. But for him to come back now, you know, 16 months later, after playing his first round in over 2 years, and win the Masters against the best and against the hottest major golfer out there right now in Brooks Koepka, and Molinari's been playing his butt off. It's hands down to me, it's the single greatest comeback of an individual athlete that we've ever seen.
Yeah, it's definitely up there. You know, Ben Hogan comes to mind for me as well, with the car accident and all the injuries that he went through.
Yep.
to come back, and he also won the Masters, I believe. I probably should have fact-checked that before, but I'm pretty positive it was the Masters that he came back and won after his accident. So that one's up there as well, you know, but yeah, I gotta say, you know, I think you could debate all day long, but I think this one definitely deserves to be in the conversation at the very least. Especially the big thing for me is that you factor in that he's in his 40s. If he would have had the back surgeries when he was 28 and came back when he was 33, 34 and did this, I wouldn't have looked at it in the same light that I do. But the fact that he's in his 40s, you know, that adds another element to me. Because, you know, the last guy I watched try to come back in his 40s was Michael Jordan with the Wizards, and that didn't go as well.
That was awful. I remember going to the Palace of Auburn Hills and watching him play, and it looked like a 42-year-old you'll see at the YMCA who used to play really, you know, a really high level of basketball, and they go out there, they limp around, they hit 7 threes, and they're happy. But Jordan couldn't make threes even. I mean, it was painful to watch, you know. You know, I'll give you a comeback. I'll give you a comeback that, you're going to laugh at the sport I pick here probably because you know. But I'm a big Olympic fan. I think the Olympics are great. And what Nancy Kerrigan did after getting walloped by Tonya Harding's crew to come back and get a medal, it's a pretty impressive comeback.
Yeah, absolutely. That one's up there. And I'm glad you actually brought up a women's sport, because when I was going through athletes, I mentioned MJ, Kobe, and Tiger as these elite in terms of their grittiness and competitiveness and demeanor, as soon as they had done saying, Serena Williams came to mind as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would put her right up there as well.
I would for sure. And Monica Seles got stabbed, didn't she? And here's another tennis player, you know, female tennis player who got stabbed and made a comeback, ended up winning an Olympic medal, I believe, later on after that crazed man ran onto the tennis court and stabbed her in the back. And so, and what Serena Williams has been doing is just, man, she might be the top female athlete of all time, especially in our day and age. I think she is.
She's unbelievable.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely. And Serena is one of the ones where, you know, we talk more and more, I feel like, about women participating in men's sports. I remember there was the big, this was like during the Olympics a couple years ago, it was Brittany Griner was going around saying she could beat DeMarcus Cousins one-on-one, which obviously is an extraordinarily absurd claim, just from, especially when she said one-on-one, I was like, okay, like, he's going to have even a bigger advantage. Like, at the end of the day, he's got 70 pounds on her and 5 inches of height. But I would like to see Serena Williams play against some of the male tennis players.
It'd be great TV. It would be great. But, you know, and what I want to see when that happens, if they were to do it, is to have the male not try to, oh, well, I'm just out here having fun. No, you aren't. Go and play for real, you know, and don't try to use some, you know, they get all these dumb excuses. Like, I think it'd be a blast to watch. And you know, the interesting thing about Serena, she's referenced Tiger Woods numerous times. And she even tweeted out today, I saw it earlier, you know, this evening, that, you know, she was in tears watching Tiger Woods win that today. And just kind of was thanking him for the inspiration and what he's meant to her. And so no surprising fact that they respect each other, have learned from each other, because their greatness and their sports is so compelling. Their stories might be different with how they've got to where they are, but they both had to battle through things to come back and then win again.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that these elite athletes have in common, and you'll know this obviously as a coach, is everyone says they want to be great and they want to be, you know, the best player in the world, but most people really don't. Say it. Like, they love the idea of being the best player in the world, you know, the fame, the fortune, and this and that. But when you see what the lifestyle is really like, and I tell our guys all the time, like, you think you want to be a PGA Tour player, you need to go hang around one for a little bit and see what their lifestyle is really like. Because, yeah, they make millions of dollars. That's awesome. But there's a sacrifice that comes with that. I mean, you don't have much of a life, especially when you start talking about the Serena Williams and the Kobe Bryants and the Michael Jordans, and the list goes on and on. I mean, they don't have a life really outside of their sport. Like, and it takes being a little bit crazy to be that elite of an athlete. You know, like we hear the stories over and over about Michael Jordan being in the gym at 5:30 in the morning after winning the NBA championship.
Yep. Like,
that's what it takes to be the best player in the entire world, because you have to outwork everybody else. And it's honestly not that glamorous of a lifestyle.
No, other than the – no, you enjoy it for a night. I mean, Tiger said he's not going to hit golf balls tomorrow. He's going to take tomorrow off. But, you know, he's going to be back at it. But even little things, like, you know, Tiger said he woke up this morning at 4 a.m. for his 9:30 or 9:20 a.m. tee off time. And I heard that, you know, last night he kind of made it – he was going to go to bed and wake up around that time. And I'm thinking – and again, I'm not going to mention names of the kids I coach right now. But we'll have a 9 a.m. practice that some kids have a tough time finding a granola bar to eat before that. And I just didn't have time to eat breakfast. And here's Tiger up at 4 a.m. getting ready, you know, stretching, having his massage, you know, getting done, having his nutritionist, have his lunch, his breakfast ready for him, his stretching routine, his warm-up routine, 5 hours. And I'm asking a kid to eat a granola bar before we practice for an hour and a half. And that's your point between what it takes to really be the best is that discipline and that sacrifice to say, I'm okay going to bed at 8:30 on a Saturday night after the third round to make sure I'm prepared and ready for Sunday morning. And, man, he was ready.
Yeah, that's – he had a look in his eye today that I hadn't seen in a long time. Brings me to my next question. I can't wait to hear your answer for this.
Oh.
Will he eclipse Jack's major record?
It's such a tough one. You know, it's funny because you asked me probably in January who I thought, you know, the majors this year, how many, and let's be honest. You said you thought he was going to win two this year. Two.
Yeah.
But you didn't pick him to win the Masters. And so so basically what you're telling me is that he's going to have a chance to win three this year now that he pulled this one off?
I really thought after he won today, the first thing that went through my head was, oh my gosh, he could do the Grand Slam in a single. Because Pebble Beach is, I mean, obviously he won the U.S. Open there by 15 shots. So, or 14 shots. It was 15.
Yeah.
So he wins by 15 shots there. So you know it's a great golf course for him. And then when I actually went there and knowing what I know about Tiger's game, I was like, oh my gosh, this place is built for Tiger because you don't have to hit driver. It's short enough you don't have to hit driver. And the greens are tiny. And distance control and iron accuracy are in an absolute premium at Pebble Beach. And I went, oh, yeah, okay, he's going to win here. And then obviously we know Bethpage Black is another great place for him. So – yeah, I'm not going to go ahead and say that, but he could get to 18 this year. He really could.
I think I look at his history, and I think, yes, he could win at Bethpage Black. You know, last time when he played there, you know, Mickelson finished second. Lefty's nowhere near the golfer he is now. I mean, it's 17 years ago when they won at Bethpage. I think he can win. I think he can pull it off one more this year. Where that would be, I'm not sure. I just, yeah, he's in a good spot right now. I think I don't know if he'll get to 18. I don't know. I want him to, obviously. I want him to get to 27, 32. I don't really, whatever. Just win them all. Like, I'd be happy. But he will win at least one more Masters. He will win one, you know, and because you mentioned earlier what the Tom Watsons, the Fred Couples, even the Jack Nicklaus at 46 was able to do at this course, because, you know, it's been lengthened in years, but you can still play back. There's not a major, you know, you could a U.S. Open, and if you're hitting a 5-iron compared to an 8-iron, so you're at a major disadvantage. Today, he was able to hit some 5-iron, 6-irons into some greens that, okay, maybe Koepka's hit an 8-iron, but it was softer. Some things went his way with the way the rain moved in a little bit, helped him out. Whereas the U.S. Open, if it gets dry, those greens, he's going to have to hit driver safe, and that could hurt him. You know, he's finished in the top 10, you know, at the Masters, you know, 13 times. He has 11 top five finishes. So over half the time he's been on that first page of the leaderboard throughout his career. And so he's going to have that chance again at Augusta moving forward to at least win one more, maybe two. Now you're putting him at 17. Yeah. He's got Pebble Beach. He's got to go back to St. Andrews Street eventually with the Open Championship, courses that he's really familiar with, which we know his history has been courses. He knows he has it's already a two to three stroke better for him than what he would shoot at somewhere else. And so will he get to 18? I sure hope so, just so the debate can just be ended that he is the best golfer of all time. But he has at least one more Masters in him for sure. So yeah, what the heck? Let's go on a limb and say, yeah, he's going to win 20 majors before he's all said and done. There you go. There's my number.
You know, what's funny is if you were to ask me, first thought that comes to your head, will Tiger win 19 majors or even 18? I would say no instinctively, just because of his age. And I worry about, is his back going to hold up forever? And can he play till he's 46, 47? You know, Phil won a PGA Tour event this year at what, 48 years old?
Yep. Yep.
And no disrespect to Phil Mickelson, not quite the athlete and in good a shape as Tiger Woods is.
But his calves, he's got unbelievable calves, though. His calves are off the charts.
He does have unbelievable, that is major facts. So, you know, I look at it like he's still got 5-6 years of really high level ability, where he's going to still have speed. I mean, Phil's swinging as fast as he ever has right now, if not faster. So I do feel like it could. And then I just, like I said, instinctively, I would say no. But the more I think about it, I'm like, it's Tiger, and I'm just not going to bet against him, because this guy, more than anyone I've ever watched, other than maybe Michael Jordan, can just will himself to wins like no other athletes can. It's incredible.
Yeah, and I just pulled it up quick to see future U.S. Open courses. In 2020, you know, Pebble Beach this year, okay, then Wingfoot, New York, okay. In 21, you're going back to Torrey Pines. He obviously likes Torrey Pines. And then 2 years later, they're at Pinehurst, of course, that he's very, very familiar with. I mean, so that kind of plays in his, and 8 years from now, he'd be 50 years old playing Pebble Beach again. So you got three chances in the next 9 years for him to win maybe one or two U.S. Opens, piece together one or two more Masters at Augusta. That puts him at that 18, 19 mark right there. You throw in maybe a PGA at, like you said, Bethpage this year, and maybe an Open Championship at St. Andrews. We're at 20. Before I even start drinking the Kool-Aid, we're at 20 right there. So he's doing it, Biss. Go to the bank. He is winning 20 majors minimum.
Can you imagine if he won the 19th at 50 years old at Pebble Beach?
But who says he can't? I mean, look at the shape he's in. Like, he's talking about ice baths today after his round. He's talking about he's not going to play as many tournaments. He's smart. But he said the tournaments I play in, I'm going to play them to win, which I know is such a silly statement. Like, who doesn't play to win? I get that. But what he's saying is that he's going to put everything he has into these rounds at the major championships, at the World Golf Championships, the Players Championships, you know. So he's only going to play 15, 16 rounds a year now moving forward. But his short game is back. Think about his short game 4 years ago. Biss, he was worse than me. That's pretty bad. I mean, I mean, he could not chip at all. Nothing. He couldn't run a bump and run. He couldn't play a flop shot. He couldn't do anything. And now he didn't have one chip this week. I can't think of the last time it is that really he duffed a chip. He had a bad one on Thursday where he went over the green on 15. He tried hitting his little skidder up there, and it didn't skid. Well, he still got up and down for par. Like, the guy's chipping because he can practice that more than anything now, is now allowing him to scramble better and not have those bad bogeys, those momentum-killing bogeys and double bogeys we saw from him during one of his 16 comebacks.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because his pitching and chipping has been phenomenal over the last year or so. And, you know, when he had it started at Iowa, when we started seeing the stab chunks and the skulls. And obviously it was really ugly, but if you know anything about Isleworth, it's a super grainy, very tight golf course. Like, it wasn't just him doing it that week. You know, it just, his got publicized more because he's Tiger. But when it continued, and especially when it started happening at TPC Scottsdale, I was thinking this could be really bad. Watching him blade easy pitches across the green at TPC Scottsdale. But if there's something to be taken from that as a golfer, it's that why are we so worried and embarrassed about bad shots when embarrassing shots happen to the absolute best players in the world? You know, and it'd be no different than in your sport. You know, we get basketball players at the high school or college level that are so embarrassed when they miss an open layup. And it's like, you know what? I can pull up 50 missed open layups per season in the NBA.
Right.
Easily. You know, wide open, no one around, miss layups. No matter how elite the athlete is, they're going to look stupid from time to time. There's mental lapses. There's mental issues that go on. You know, mental issues, I say, from just a confidence standpoint of just every once in a while, these things happen. And, you know, he was able to recover from that spell of poor chipping. And yeah, it's been incredible. So I do want to transition now, as I brought up the NBA briefly. So you are a basketball coach and a brilliant basketball mind. And I am obviously borderline obsessed, especially the NBA. You know, this is something that's so funny for our listeners. You're a basketball coach. I'm a golf coach. And I almost never watch any golf. And you almost never watch any basketball because we work in it.
Yes, yes.
I spend my entire life watching golf all day, every day. And so I don't want to go home and watch more of it on TV. And I know you're the same way with basketball, but then you're obsessed with golf.
Obsessed.
And every time I talk to you, it's, oh my gosh, did you see the shot that Phil Mickelson hit in Wednesday's practice? I'm like, no, I didn't see that. I don't care.
Yeah. Yeah. I hit you up the one time with Luke List, his height and weight, and asked you, what do I have to do to get to be like Luke List? And you looked at me like, what is wrong with you, Phil? But yeah, you're right. You're right. Yes.
All right. So the NBA playoffs are also starting up. So let's talk a little NBA. If there's anything to be talked about, do you think there is? Are the Warriors just running away with it? Or do you think there's some other contenders this year?
Well, I'll say this. The one thing I hope the Pistons, for all of us, just win one game. Can we just get one win this series? Okay. That'd be nice to see. Do I think the Warriors run away? I think the Warriors, yeah, I heard somebody say they're going to go 16-0 in the playoffs, and I don't think that's happening whatsoever. I was really surprised yesterday. I thought the Nuggets would be a team that would have a chance to maybe hang with the Warriors or maybe upset them if they met in the Western Conference Finals. And for them to go and lose their first game at home against the Spurs was really surprising to me. You know, and I think that you know, the Spurs come back and just always show what they're capable of doing, and how they keep on doing it is really incredible. I don't think they run away with it. But I do think, yes, the Warriors are going to win the NBA Finals. I really do. You know, you look at Milwaukee, I just don't think that they've been challenged enough and don't have the experience to be able to go on the road in the NBA Finals if they do match up with the Warriors and take them down. I still even see Boston having a chance in that second round to upset the Milwaukee Bucks, and we'll get a Celtics-Sixers rematch in the Eastern Conference Finals. I say that even though Brooklyn upsets the Sixers and they're checking cell phone messages during games and things, and who knows what might come with that. But I would love to see a Trailblazers match up with the Warriors just so we can watch Lillard play four or five more games. It would be fun for us all to see. Warriors are winning the playoffs again, and then we'll see. Then the free agent market hits, and who knows, they might look a little different come next year.
Yeah, no question. When I look at the playoffs this year, the thing that's so disappointing is to see the dysfunction in Boston, because I think if there was a team that we thought from a talent and coaching perspective, right, you have as far as top to bottom in depth, I think Boston would be probably that next team with the Warriors, just in terms of, if you were to say on paper who looks the best, and then you put that coach on top of it, and I think most people would agree, you know, Brad Stevens, the top three or four coach in the NBA. And to see the dysfunction that's happened there, and, you know, it makes you feel like they don't have much of a chance, which is too bad, because I was saying before the year started, I really thought if anyone could do it, I thought Boston would have a chance. But I think it speaks a little bit to Kyrie. You know, I've never been on the Kyrie train, and I don't know. Like, I hate saying stuff like this because it's not like I know him or I'm in the locker room or I have any idea. But you get the feeling from the outside looking in, he's a little bit of a problem in the locker room.
I would agree with that. And you hear stories about that. Now, you mentioned free agency a few times, and yet you look at him now, he's a free agent after this season. And so does something in him spark the, I can be a leader, I can help this team, I don't mind passing to Ingram or Hayward or whatever, and if he finds a way to get himself into the finals, what does that do to that max contract here come July 1st, compared to if he just tanks and just does nothing. Does something else, does that then change where he ranks then and what happens in the offseason movement? And are millions of dollars worth it enough to Kyrie to shut up and play basketball? Because when he plays and he's locked in, he's a great two-way player. He can guard you. He can score it. He can set you up. He is a really good player. And so maybe that plays into his mind a little bit, and he comes out and things change, and all of a sudden you see Boston, you know, in the finals. I'd like to see it, because I like watching, you know, obviously Coach Stevens, I think, is one of the best NBA guys in late clock and ending game situations. I think he is the best. Kyrie, obviously, it's a major key how he plays for him.
Yeah, no doubt. It's tough. And, you know, we'll transition to Frizz. I agree. I think the Warriors are going to win it all. I don't know how they wouldn't. It's just.
Do the Stones win a game? Do the Pistons win a game? Do they win one?
I would have said yes, but I don't know what's going on with Blake.
Nobody does.
Is he hurt? Is he not? He's questionable, doubtful. You know, they haven't really said what the injury is. It's something with his knee. And it's sad for me, because I was all on the Blake train in terms of, man, this guy's so competitive. And, you know, he fights every minute. He's what we've needed in Detroit. But this is making me wonder a little bit, you know. That's why I'm hoping it's just more serious, and it's the opposite of what I think a lot of us think it is, where it's actually more serious, and they're not saying don't worry about it. It's nothing big, but he's questionable. I shouldn't say I'm hoping it's something more serious, but for kind of my view of him, because if this is just some little nagging injury and you're thinking about sitting playoff games out for it, that's not great.
No.
If he's going to sit out playoff games with something that isn't serious, we're overpaying by double what we're getting in return. I mean, as any athlete, and this has always been something I believed, if you want to be a truly elite athlete, you have to be told you can't play to not play.
Yes.
And that's, I've always been under that opinion. You know, if you're an elite athlete, I don't care how bad it hurts, whatever, if the doctor says, hey, we're going to clear you, you can go tonight, you got to go. The only way you don't play is if they restrain you from getting on that court, especially in a playoff game. I mean, come on.
Willis Reed, there's a comeback story. We start with comeback stories. We could come full circle here. Willis Reed, he was not being denied. He came out and played.
Yeah. I mean, you have to. I mean, you hear the stories, and what you realize, because you hear some of these stories and see some of these athletes and what they play through, there's very few injuries you can't actually play through. Now, if the coach holds you out because your effectiveness is so low because the injury is so severe, then that's another thing. But if the coach feels like even with this horrible injury you can play and you can help the team, then you better get in there. I mean, let's not forget, Byron Leftwich played a college game with a broken leg.
Had to be carried by his offensive lineman to the next play.
Yeah, like this, and that's football, by the way. Like, we're 250-pound men that are very fast are crashing into you, you know? So there's not a lot of injuries you can't play through, especially when it comes to the playoffs. But, you know, it's a different time and age, and I think these guys – you know, someone in Blake's case, this doesn't make sense, but let's say you're a pending free agent this summer. You know, I'm not going to say I get it. I don't really love the decision, but they do think more ahead now, and they think about financial, and I need to be as healthy as possible in the offseason for free agency. So let's transition into that. What do you think, if you were a betting man, where people are going to wind up? So this is a huge summer. I mean, we have a lot of enormous names in free agency all this
year.
Obviously, the big rumors are KD and Kyrie to New York.
I agree with it.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. From everything it sounds like, that's pretty much a done deal.
If New York wins, whether it's the top pick or the only – I think one thing it could change is if New York, based on the lottery and everything else, if they are in a position where they cannot draft Zion Williamson, I think they want to draft Zion Williamson, which I don't think he's going to be a great pro. I respect the guy because he could have just held out and not played after his injury, and he came back and he battled for Duke. And but if they can get Zion Williamson, Kevin Durant, and Kyrie Irving, I think they do it. I think the one hang up is if they can't get Zion Williamson, you have to take Morant. I mean, the guy, Morant is unbelievable. And so can you go out there with Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, and Morant? Or what do you do with that pick then? If Ja Morant is the best player available at the pick you have with the Knicks, what do you do? And you know, I don't think you can have Kyrie Irving and Morant out there. I guess you could at the same time, but that's two kind of small guards who want the ball in their hands, who want to set people up. And so I think that could change. It would be the only thing that would change that from happening would be how the NBA draft goes. And that's my only concern right there. But other than that, I believe Durant and Irving are going to go together. They're going to go to New York. They get their max contracts. You know, Klay Thompson, I think if Klay were to leave the Warriors and go join LeBron and Anthony Davis with the Lakers, I think the simple solution for the Warriors to stay having that shooter is I think J.J. Redick's a free agent as well. Have J.J. Redick leave the Sixers and go out to the West Coast, where he kind of started with the Clippers there for a while. I think he joins the Warriors to fill that void because you have to have another shooter to help space that floor with the system they play. So yeah, those are my four or five names. I think if I'm the Pistons, I think you try to bring in somebody if you can. If it's a Kemba Walker free agent, it would be a nice pickup for us, I think, just to get a consistent score. And from there, you know more names than I do, but those are the ones I know for fact and where I like to see them end up at.
Yeah, and Kemba Walker was the one that I was hoping the Pistons would pursue. But at the end of the day, I don't know that Detroit can build through free agency because
it's. Well, then stop drafting Luke Kennard.
Yeah. are you telling me you think Luke Kennard is not as good as Donovan Mitchell? Come on.
I mean, exactly. Exactly.
I just, I feel like Detroit has just become, and it's more this way than ever, where, as I just alluded to, athletes are thinking more now about money and setting themselves up financially. And so the small market teams just, they don't get free agents anymore. Like if you're not on the West Coast or the East Coast or in Miami, it's going to be really tough to get free agents. You know, I think Oklahoma City got so lucky this year by re-signing Paul George. And when I say they got lucky is they got lucky that Paul George seems to be a really good dude and that he was like, you know what? I love Russ. I love his fire. I love his competitiveness. And I want to build something here. I'm not about just going back home to LA and, you know, being in among all the stars and getting all the endorsement deals. But most people aren't like Paul George and they want to be in the huge markets. And so I don't see Kemba Walker going to Detroit, especially because they're a losing team. You know, why would he leave one small market losing team to go to another small market losing team? You know, unless Detroit just pays an obscene amount of money for him, which they don't really have because we're already paying Blake Griffin an obscene amount of money. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting. You know, and one thing you brought up with the New York thing, because I do agree, and I'll be curious to get your opinion on this, because my opinion has always been when it comes to the draft, and the NBA, I think you draft best available, and in the NFL, I think you draft by need, unless the best available is so much better than whatever your need is. And the reason I've always felt that way is the NBA is the most tradable league there is. Right? Like you can just trade people left and right. I mean, it seems like there's a trade every week in the NBA. It's just so simple to move people around. And I think I feel it especially as a Pistons fan because of obviously I can barely ever even talk about it without wanting to punch a hole in the walls, the 2003 draft. Because we had, and I said this until probably this year with Zion Williamson and Kevin Durant made me question a little bit, but outside of maybe those two names, Carmelo Anthony is the best college player I ever watched. Like Carmelo Anthony, his freshman year at Syracuse, it was ridiculous. I mean, it was crazy how good he was as a freshman and how developed his game was. And yeah, he didn't end up being he's a Hall of Famer. But he didn't end up being a winner, and you can debate why and why not. You know, obviously maybe there were some things lacking from a mental perspective there and a competitiveness, but he was the most surefire pro I could remember coming out of college. You know, I just thought there is no way this guy doesn't average 20 points a game minimum for his career. And for us to give the reason of, well, we already have Tayshaun Prince. Like, are you kidding me? You know, like, that's your reason for not wanting to draft Carmelo Anthony, who's like the probably the most hyped prospect, other than that happened to be the year that LeBron James was coming out. But, you know, Carmelo was one of the most hyped players I'd seen in a long time. And I just thought he was such a guarantee. You get really hyped people where they're a prospect, right? Like, a name that kind of mine for that that's of recent is like an Andrew Wiggins. Like, Andrew Wiggins was very hyped, but I don't think everyone was sold on him, because we looked at it as like, there's a lot of holes in his game. You know, like, he's an elite athlete, but will he develop? You know, Carmelo Anthony was developed. Like, he was ready. And you knew he was going to be a great pro. And then we said, well, we have Tayshaun Prince, who is a good defender and has a bunch of holes offensively, so we're not going to draft this guy. Like, are you kidding me? And I didn't understand the logic behind, why don't you just draft Carmelo and then trade one of them? Like, it's so easy to trade people. So I do agree with you. I think the Knicks should draft Ja Morant if they get the number two pick. And then you're obviously not going to, if you sign Kyrie, you're not going to trade him. So then you have to trade Ja Morant. I think you could get a really good veteran player to complement Kyrie and Durant for Ja Morant.
And I think you're right. Let's just call, well, even your point about, you know, you have Tayshaun Prince, you can't draft Carmelo Anthony. That's even more of a reason to draft Carmelo Anthony, with what Prince could do defensively compared to what Carmelo Anthony can't do defensively. It's even more of a reason to say, okay, we're going to be okay. We always know we can have Tayshaun on the opposing team's best guard, and Anthony, we'll just find a matchup for him, you know. But and then you look at that same draft. Is that the same year? I believe we drafted Carlos Delfino in the first round. We had two first round picks that year, and came out with Darko and Delfino. Where, yeah, if you take that number two pick and that whatever it was in late first round pick, and you trade them together, you're still going to get Dwayne Wade, Chris Bosh, Kirk Heinrich, all these guys that were better pros than what we had. And so that was definitely mismanaged by the executives with the Pistons, for sure.
And I have no doubt. I think Darko is the worst pick. I think there's a difference between biggest bust and worst pick.
Yeah. Right?
Biggest bust is someone everyone thought was going to be good and didn't turn out to be good. Where Darko is the worst pick in the history of probably sport, just professional sports drafts, because no one knew who he was. No one, I don't think, thought he was going to be that great, especially compared to Carmelo and Wade and Bosch and the other great names in that draft. And we just went with him anyway. I mean, it was insane. Like, I don't think anybody outside of Joe Dumars and whoever was in his camp thought that was remotely an okay idea.
No, because people reference Sam Bowie, and that Sam Bowie was drafted before Jordan. But Sam Bowie, he at least lasted in the NBA. He at least had a couple years where he actually had productivity, you know. And so I agree with you. I mean, Darko is the only one that might rival. I mean, and again, why is this always Detroit teams? My goodness, is Joey Harrington was just brutal for the Lions, you know. But yeah. I mean, so was Charles Williams, so was Mike Williams. Not my boss. The other wide receiver, you know, we've had numerous picks in Detroit that are just awful, you know. Yeah. So
yeah, but the majority of those that you mentioned, they turned out bad for other reasons, like Sam Bowie. Really, he is not that big of a bust. Like, he's a bust because Michael Jordan was drafted after him, but Sam Bowie was a great player, and he had injury issues forever. Like, he was constantly injured in the pros, just like Greg Oden to me is not a bust. Like, he's a bust, but he wasn't a bad pick. That was a great pick. He could have been a great player, but he just got the injury bug. You know, Charles Rogers, and you're going back to the Lions, right? We drafted Charles Rogers number two overall as a wide receiver. Charles Rogers was going to be a hell of a pro until he decided he didn't want to be.
Yes.
It's not as simple as that. Like, he just stopped going to practice and decided this life wasn't for him. But those weren't picks that I think when they made them that we went, oh my gosh, what did you just do? Where Darko was like, as soon as we made that pick, I was like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life.
It's really bad.
It ended up being that way. So
yeah.
All right. Well, we'll wrap things up. I appreciate you coming on today, Phil. This was a bunch of fun. I know you're on cloud nine. You probably won't sleep a wink tonight.
Well, I had to go to the Y and get an extra long run in today just so I burned some energy up after that. I'll say that was some stressful. I'm serious. That was 3 to 4 hours of straight stress as I was texting with you. You're trying to tell me it's okay, and I'm thinking, no, it's not okay. He has a four-footer left. It's not okay. I still thought on 18, I was waiting for Molinari to hold out from the fairway, make it 13 under, and force Tiger to have to par the last hole to win it. I was waiting for it. I was. I had no – I was just nervous. I was scared. You know, it was just kept eating my popcorn to keep my mouth shut, and that's what I did to pass time.
Yeah, I never – after he played that shot in between the bunkers on 12, I thought, yep, he's locked in every way. I felt like it was over at that point. So
you're a lot wiser than I am.
All right. Well, we appreciate you coming out again, and you enjoy your night, Mr. Sayers.
Thanks, Biss.